And I met a broker friend of Conrad's who was trying to get some of Conrad's business. We wanted to go to the best restaurant in town. The broker swore we wouldn't be able to get a table on such short notice and without a reservation. Well, we went to the restaurant anyway, and I slipped the maitre d' $100 bills until he got us a table. It cost $600, but it was worth it to upstage the other broker. The money wasn't important because we hadn't worked for it. Those $100 bills were not nearly as big as the ones I had worked for in the pit. Profit motive, P-R-O-F-I-T, or profit motive, P-R-O-P-H-E-T. There are two kinds of reward in the world, recognition and money. Are you in the market for recognition, congratulating yourself for calling every market move ahead of time and explaining the move after the fact? Or are you in the market to make money? Are you more interested in the psychological reward of gold stars than the financial reward of gold coins? Are you trying to be right or to make money? Are you motivated by the profit, P-R-O-P-H-E-T, motive, or the profit, P-R-O-F-I-T, motive? To answer, you have to figure out which type of participant you are, bettor, gambler, investor, trader, or speculator. You do this by examining the characteristics and behaviors you are exhibiting, not the activity. That is, opining the outcome of a political race, playing at a blackjack table, buying stocks, trading in the pit, or buying or selling commodity futures from your Bluebird Wander Lodge. The characteristics displayed determine the activity. Embarking upon games or entering the markets can be either an end or a means. It is an end for people who yearn for the stimulation and excitement that the vicissitudes of a game or the market provide them, gamblers, or those whose vanity is flattered by the display of their superiority in playing a game that requires cunning and skill, bettors. It is a means for professionals who want to make money, speculators, investors, and traders. One morning, Joe Siegel and I were on the trading floor when one of my accounts called in from vacation. "What's lumber doing today?" "It's limit up." "Why?" "The cash market is a lot stronger because storms in the Northwest are making it hard to get the lumber out from the mills." "Where's cash?" I told him prices for 2x4s of white fir, Western SPF, and green Douglas fir, and continued reading the news wire. The green in green Douglas fir refers to the fact that it has been newly cut. It has not been dried. Just like someone who is new at something is referred to as green. Siegel looked over at me and said, "I never have understood why they get such a premium price for lumber that they paint green." I couldn't believe it. Here was Joe Siegel, easily trading more lumber futures than anyone else on the floor, and he didn't even know the difference between green and kiln-dried lumber in the cash market. I wasn't sure if he was kidding me or not, but looking back, I can only now see how it was possible for him to be such a successful trader without knowing that green lumber isn't actually painted green. He was a trader, and he relied on short-term information like order flow and price action to make his decisions because his time frame was short-term. He didn't let longer-term information more suited for investor types interfere with his trading. He knew the difference between traders and investors. Eight. The psychological crowd. Man is extremely uncomfortable with uncertainty. To deal with his discomfort, man tends to create a false sense of security by substituting certainty for uncertainty. It becomes the herd instinct. Bennett W. Goodspeed, The Dow Jones, T.A.O. Jones Averages. One day in the summer of 1980, my partner, Larry Broderick, called me and said, "Hey, Jim, My stockbroker just called me with a tip, and we gotta buy this stock. Some company I can't even remember the name of, I told you I made investments that I couldn't remember, was a rumored takeover candidate. The broker said the talk was if the takeover happens, it would probably be within 60 days and probably at $60 a share. At the time, the stock was trading at $25. So we checked to see if there were options on the stock. The 35 strike calls were trading way out of the money and with very little time premium. They were trading for 1/16th or 1/8th. You could buy thousands of these things for very little money. Well, we liked buying thousands of anything, so we bought thousands of these call options. And I did exactly the same thing I would do later in the bean oil. Almost everybody I knew had to have a couple of hundred of these options. Among all of our clients and acquaintances, we had tens of thousands of the 35 strike calls. I'd call my futures customers and say, "Look, I can't sell you this stuff, but trust me. Go call your stockbroker and buy some." Now, who's not going to believe me when I tell them to buy something I can't even sell them or make any money on? They believe. So they bought the options. They all bought them. Everybody we knew bought them. Then the stock started to move. $25, $26, $27, $28, $29, and volume started picking up too. Pretty soon the options started moving even though they were still trading for less than $1. When an option goes from 1/16th to 3/4, if you own 2,000 or 3,000 of them, you're talking some serious money. I had control of 300,000 shares at $35. At the $60 takeover price, that's a $7,500,000 profit. Naturally, once something starts to work, it's real easy to get people to believe you. Okay, I told you to buy these options 2 weeks ago when they were at 1/16th. Now they are at 3/4. Do you want to get in or do you want to stay stupid? If I knew you, you had to have at least a couple of hundred of these things just for health insurance. What do I mean by health insurance? If I tell you that something which costs 1/16th today might be worth $25 inside of 1 month, you have to buy some of it. It's health insurance because once I tell you a story like that and you don't buy some and it happens, you're going to kill yourself. That's health insurance. In 3 weeks, the stock was up to $37 or $38, and our options were in the money. We had paid 1/16th for them, and now they were worth $3 or $4. Then, one Friday afternoon, after the futures markets had closed, we were all up in my office, and I was holding court. The phone rang. It was my partner, Larry. "Holy shit, they just stopped trading in our stock, Jim. News to follow." "That's it? That's it!" I screamed. "It's done! Holy... it's done!" They had ceased trading in our stock. News pending. Somebody was going to pay $60 for this stock that we owned at $35. We went home for the weekend thinking that Monday morning we were going to be millionaires. One of our biggest customers had 10,000 or 15,000 of these options, and he called British Airways to find out what it would cost to rent the Concorde, just for us. He actually wanted to lease the Concorde and fly to London to celebrate. We were all going to meet in New York at the Waldorf Astoria, get on the Concorde, and go to London and have a good time. I don't remember the exact figure, but the rental would have been like $200,000 or $300,000. That kind of money wouldn't have been a problem considering that we were all going to be multimillionaires come Monday morning. Well, Monday morning, the stock was still under the news pending restriction, but the options opened and they were higher. After about half an hour, the stock finally opened. Down $6. The news that came out was the pending potential buyout had been killed. Our options expired worthless. But for a weekend, I thought I was going to be a real $6 million man. Emotions and the crowd. Perhaps the most frequently cited reason for losses in the market is emotion. These explanations run the gamut from simply citing greed and fear to others that go into great detail on emotions, their source from early childhood, and their effect on you. But examining individual emotions misses the point. Emotions are neither good nor bad. They simply are. They cannot be avoided. But emotionalism, that is, decision-making based on emotions, is bad, can be controlled, and should be avoided. So instead of examining each of the many individual emotions, this chapter will focus on the entity that epitomizes emotionalism, the crowd. Emotions are very strong feelings arising subjectively rather than through conscious mental effort. As will be shown shortly, the fundamental characteristic of a crowd is that it is exclusively guided by unconscious motives. In other words, it is guided by emotions. If you don't have conscious control of your actions, then your emotions have control of you. Therefore, in order to understand how emotionalism adversely affects you as an investor, trader, or speculator, you have to know the characteristics and behaviors of the crowd. The 19th century philosopher Gustave Le Bon put it this way: "Crowds are somewhat like the Sphinx of ancient fable. It is necessary to arrive at a solution to the problem offered by their psychology, or resign ourselves to being devoured by them." Conventional views of the crowd. 1. Runaway markets. All of us are familiar with the old market sayings about the public and the crowd, such as, "Don't follow the crowd," "Be contrarian," "Trade opposite the general public." But most people don't really know what a crowd is, much less how to recognize it, and still less whether they are part of the crowd. Most explanations of the crowd are actually studies of, or references to, the investing frenzies that have gripped mankind throughout history. For example, in his 1841 book, Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds, British historian Charles Mackay recounts, among other manias, one of the more famous times in history when the crowd lost its collective head: Holland's Tulip Mania. In 1634, a speculative boom in Holland's primitive stock market spilled over into the flower marts, similar to the manner in which the speculative boom in the world's stock markets in the 1980s spilled over into the art market. People in all stations of life converted their property into cash and invested it in tulip bulbs. At the peak of the tulip market in February 1637, single bulbs sold for prices equal to 10 years' wages of the average worker. Looking at such historical speculative episodes in search of common patterns has produced various models that describe the stages of the process at work when a market is driven by a crowd. For instance, in Manias, Panics, and Crashes by Charles P. Kindleberger, we find the Minsky model. 1. Displacement, some exogenous event, war, crop failure, etc., shocks the macroeconomic system. 2. Opportunities, the displacement creates profitable opportunities in some sectors of the economy and closes down other sectors. Investment and production focuses on the profitable sectors, and a boom is underway. 3. Credit expansion. An expansion of credit feeds the boom. 4. Euphoria. Speculation for price increases couples with investment for production, sale. Another common pattern used to describe the crowd overtaking a market is 1. Speculation. 2. Credit expansion. 3. Financial distress. 4. Crisis. 5. Panic and crash. There are variations on these models, but essentially the crowd has been studied, described, and explained in terms of historical events rather than as a mental process that can happen to individuals. Thus, the crowd is seen as some kind of anonymous they who got caught up in a runaway market. 2. Contrarian approach. Another way of viewing the crowd is the contrarian approach to the market, in which people look for universal endorsement at market tops and capitulation at market bottoms. Contrarians take market positions opposite the crowd. But you can't always be positioned opposite the crowd. In fact, you probably will be positioned the same way as the crowd at least some of the time, because it's the only way your idea can become profitable. The crowd must come in and move the market the way you were positioned for it to go. These conventional views of the crowd do not serve our purpose. Knowing the patterns of manias, panics, and crashes may be helpful in recognizing when such episodes are beginning to repeat themselves in the market, but these patterns reveal little about an individual's decision-making process. The patterns describe market events, not the mental state of an individual forming part of a crowd. Since our focus is on market participants rather than historians or economists, we don't need models to warn us of impending manias or panics in a market. Rather, we need a model to alert us to when we are becoming part of a crowd. What is a crowd? In the ordinary sense, the word crowd means a gathering of individuals, regardless of what has brought them together. But according to Le Bon, in his book, The Crowd, from a psychological perspective, the word means something entirely different. When the sentiments and ideas of all the people in the gathering take one and the same direction, and their conscious individual personality disappears, then the gathering has become a psychological crowd. It is my contention that this process does not require a gathering of people. An isolated individual who displays those characteristics is, for all intents and purposes, a member of the crowd. Can you be classified as part of the crowd even if you're sitting alone in your den following the markets? Yes, if you're wavering back and forth like a candle in the wind, swayed by every news story or price change on the screen. Are you displaying the characteristics of a crowd in your individual decision-making process? If you are evidencing the tendencies, emotions, and characteristics of the crowd in your actions and reactions to the market, then you are making a crowd trade. The basic distinction between the individual and the crowd is that the individual acts after reasoning, deliberation, and analysis. A crowd acts on feeling, emotion, and impulses. An individual will think out his options, whereas a crowd is swayed by emotional viewpoints rather than by reasoning. In the crowd, emotional and thoughtless opinions spread wildly via imitation and contagion. Learning the characteristics of a crowd and how it forms will provide a structure that shows how emotionalism affects your decision-making. Once you know the structure, you'll know what to avoid in order to prevent emotionalism. Characteristics of a crowd. There are three main characteristics that describe the mental state of an individual forming a part of a crowd. As you will see, the same characteristics can also be exhibited by an individual making investment and trading decisions. 1. A sentiment of invincible power. The individual forming part of a crowd acquires a sentiment of invincible power. The improbable doesn't exist for the crowd or its members. According to Webster's Dictionary, sentiment is a complex combination of feelings and opinions as a basis for judgment. This feeling of invincible power tends to make a person yield to instincts and emotions that he would ordinarily keep in check. But the crowd is anonymous, and anyone in the crowd will shirk responsibility for his actions. In a crowd, people do things they wouldn't ordinarily do because they are anonymous and feed off the power provided by the crowd. The responsibility that keeps individuals in control vanishes in the crowd. Witness the actions of fans who storm the football field after a victory and tear down the goalposts. This is how I was in the bean oil trade. I was invincible. I could do no wrong. As far as I was concerned, there was no question that the trade was going to make $10 million. 2. Contagion. The American Heritage Dictionary defines contagion as the tendency to spread as an influence or emotional state. This is like the spontaneous wave at a football stadium or the riots that break out in a city after a home team's championship victory. It's like being hypnotized or mesmerized. Watching prices change on the computer screen, getting quotes from your broker throughout the day, seeing the stock ticker on the bottom of your TV screen, or just being in the market and experiencing prices going up and down can serve as the hypnotist's watch swinging back and forth in front of his subject. This describes my mental state in the motorhome when I was keeping up with the markets on the telephone. 3. Suggestibility. The best way to describe this is the way a hypnotized subject, in the hands of his hypnotizer, responds to the power of suggestion. He is highly suggestible and no longer conscious of his acts. Under the influence of a suggestion, he will undertake the accomplishment of certain acts with irresistible impetuosity. This sounds just like me when I was driving down the Jersey Turnpike, glued to my telephone and listening to the changing prices, and when I took the suggestions on the bean oil trade and the stock trades and ran with them. In the special state of fascination, contagion, an individual is in the hands of the price changes on the screen, the words and suggestions of whoever got him into the market in the first place, or anyone else from whom he seeks opinions. The most striking peculiarity presented by a psychological crowd is the following. Once individuals have formed a crowd, however like or unlike their mode of life, their occupation, their character, or their intelligence, that fact that they have been transformed into a crowd puts them in possession of a sort of collective mind that makes them act in a manner quite different from that in which each individual would act were he in a state of isolation. A person in a crowd also allows himself to be induced to commit acts contrary to his most obvious interests. One of the most incomprehensible features of a crowd is the tenacity with which the members adhere to erroneous assumptions despite mounting evidence to challenge them. So when an individual adheres to a market position despite the mounting losses, he is a crowd. These observations explain what happens when you do something you said you weren't going to do or fail to do something you said you would do. They also explain why I stayed in bean oil after I began losing more than I ever had made in the position. It was obviously not in my best interest to take money from other ventures and borrow money to pay for the losses that were accumulating. Why would I let a once profitable position go to the point where I actually had to borrow money to stay in the position? If you had posed that possibility to me in 1973 or 1976 or even in August 1983, I would have completely rejected the notion that I could ever do such a thing. If you have ever had a position on and intended to do one thing but actually did something else, then you were a member of the psychological crowd and made a crowd trade, whether you knew it or not. Otherwise, you would have done what you originally intended. The point is that in addition to the traditional views of the crowd in the markets, there is also such thing as a crowd investment or a crowd trade that an individual can make, even without the presence or influence of other people. The similarities between a psychological crowd and a losing market participant are striking. Remember, it is not a function of a quantity of individuals that determines if a psychological crowd is formed. Rather, it is a function of the characteristics displayed. If a person is exhibiting these characteristics, then he is part of a psychological crowd and is making crowd trades. The market doesn't even have to be frothy for an individual to make a crowd trade, nor does it have to fall into either of the crowd models described earlier. The market can just be going sideways, and he can still be making a crowd trade if he is exhibiting the special characteristics of crowds, such as impulsiveness, irritability, incapacity to reason, exaggeration of sentiments, absence of critical judgment, etc. If this isn't the profile of an emotional and losing market participant, then nothing is. It describes me perfectly when I was in the bean oil trade and the takeover stock trade, not to mention many other trades. The two models below are adapted from Le Bon's book, The Crowd. While he was interested in the processes and characteristics of mob behavior from a sociological point of view, we are interested in how those processes and characteristics exhibit themselves in individuals making market decisions. Two psychological crowd models. Delusion model. The delusion model describes the process of an individual becoming part of a psychological crowd before he has a position on. 1. Expectant attention. 2. Suggestion made. 3. Process of contagion. 4. Acceptance by all present. This model illustrates exactly how the net loser participates in the markets. He is ready. Because he is so anxious to make money, he is in a state of expectant attention. He hears a tip or a casual comment about the market. Enthusiasm is contagious and he goes into a hypnotic-like trance, takes the tip as gospel, and acts on it. Compare this to when you've made hasty, impulsive, spur-of-the-moment decisions or followed someone else's tip to get in or out of the market. I went through the same process when I entered the takeover stock trade and the bean oil position. In both of these instances, as well as many others, I was in an expectant state of attention, ready to make money. Once the trades were suggested to me, a process of contagion took over, and I acted. The reason people who try to make back losses quickly lose again is because they are in an expectant state of attention, ready to pounce on any trade suggested. This makes them part of the crowd, emotional to the extreme, and bound to lose. The illusion model. The illusion model accurately describes the process of an individual becoming part of a psychological crowd after he has a position on. 1. Affirmation. 2. Repetition. 3. Prestige. 4. Contagion. Consider the following scenario. An opinion about the market is expressed, affirmation, either by you or someone else. It gets repeated, repetition, to others. Friends ask what you think about the markets and you repeat the opinion, selling yourself on the idea once again. Next, prestige comes into play. Prestige is a sort of domination exercised over us by an individual, a work, an idea, or a wish. It entirely paralyzes our critical faculty and fills us with wonderment. The market is going your way. You look like a hero. You're so smart. Prestige. You have the adulation of your peers. Emotionalism overwhelms you. Contagion. You're hypnotized. The illusion model can also be applied to losing trades if the prestige involved comes from your daring actions and being able to take the punishment of a losing position. Sure, the market is against you, but you're courageous and you can take it. The market is wrong and will turn around. You take pride in your courage to go against the crowd because, according to market lore, the crowd is supposed to be wrong. People marvel at your ability to stay with a losing position. Once again, you become hypnotized, contagion, and are out of control. The trade will end only when you are forced out by external forces, for example, money, family, margin clerk. This is exactly what I did once the bean oil position started going against me. Why else would I let the once profitable bean oil position erode to the point where I'd basically lost my prior life? Emotions. Recall from basic economics that markets exist to satisfy the wants and needs of consumers. This means people make purchases for only one of two reasons: to feel better, satisfying a want, or to solve a problem, satisfying a need. Trying to do the former in the financial markets is dangerous. If you are in the markets to achieve a certain emotional state or create self-esteem, then you have some psychological disorders and need to see a therapist. Just as compulsive gambling, which is a personality disorder, isn't the focus of this book, neither are the other psychological pathologies. Our discussion only addresses the normal emotional ups and downs of participating in the markets, not the psychological disorders. Remember, emotions per se are neither good nor bad. They just are. It's emotionalism we are trying to avoid. Hope-fear paradox. Psychologists and psychiatrists usually advise against suppressing emotions, and suppression usually involves negative emotions. Rarely, if ever, are patients treated for suppressing positive emotions. Surprising as it may sound, however, both positive and negative emotions can have detrimental effects on your decisions and performance in the markets. To see why this is true, let's examine the ailments of hope and fear and their unique link to the crowd. Ordinarily, greed and fear are cited as the two driving emotions of market participants. However, hope and fear are the primary emotions. Greed is simply hope run amok. The advice on hope and fear is almost as conflicting as the advice the pros give us on making money. We have all been told not to buy or sell a stock or make a trade based on hope or fear. Never hope that a position will go our way, and never fear that a position won't go our way. We have been told that hope causes us to buy a stock after it has already gone up, and we buy it at the top. Fear causes us to sell a stock after it has already gone down a lot, and we wind up selling at the bottom. Or in the words of the father of contrary thinking, Humphrey Neal, the crowd is most enthusiastic and optimistic when it should be cautious and prudent, and it is most fearful when it should be bold. On the other hand, we read Jesse Livermore's advice that we should hope when we would fear, and fear when we would hope. That is, we should hope our profits will become bigger profits instead of fearing the profits will turn around, and we should fear our losses will become bigger losses instead of hoping the losses will turn around. The conflicting advice is explained by the paradox that hope and fear are merely two sides of the same coin. In other words, more often than not, you are likely to experience both hope and fear simultaneously. When you're long and the market is going up, you, 1, hope it will keep going, but, 2, fear it won't. If your fear is great enough, you will get out and hope the market turns down. When you're long and the market goes down, you, 1, hope it will turn around, but, 2, fear it won't. If your fear is great enough, you'll get out and hope that it keeps going down. When you're not long in the market but want to be and the market goes up, you, 1, hope it will temporarily turn around to let you in, but, 2, fear it will keep going. If your fear is great enough, you will buy and hope the market keeps going up. The point is, focusing on individual emotions can be quite confusing, and it is better to focus on emotionalism instead. The best way to do that is by understanding the psychological crowd. Mania and panic, where hope and fear meet the crowd. As the epigraph to this chapter states, man is extremely uncomfortable with uncertainty, tries to substitute certainty for uncertainty, and, in doing so, succumbs to the herd instinct. That uncertainty about the future also elicits two primary emotional responses, hope and fear. We hope the future will turn out well, but we fear it won't. As members of the crowd, we will always take these emotions to extremes. When the herd instinct combines with hope and fear in a market environment, we get panics and manias. According to the American Heritage Dictionary, a mania is an inordinately intense enthusiasm or hope for something, a craze, a fad, or a behavior that enjoys brief popularity and pertains to the common people or people at large. It defines a panic as a sudden overpowering terror, often affecting many people at once. It also says to see the synonym fear. Notice that the definition of both mania and panic have direct references to hope and fear and the crowd. Manias and panics don't have to be full-scale mass population events like the tulips in Holland. They can occur on the scale of an individual making decisions about entering and exiting the market. Since an isolated individual can be classified as a crowd, then the same individual can get involved in a solitary panic or mania. And the market doesn't even have to be frothy for this to happen. It can be going sideways, and the individual can experience a solitary panic or mania simply by exhibiting the characteristics of a crowd coupled with hope or fear. In a solitary panic, crowd behavior combines with an individual's fear of losing money or fear of missing an opportunity to profit and becomes the primary reason for acting or failing to act. In a solitary mania, crowd behavior combines with an individual's intense hope for profit or hope that a losing position will turn around and becomes the primary reason for acting or failing to act. So instead of trying to monitor yourself for all the different emotions and what they might mean, simply monitor yourself for the few stages of crowd formation. By avoiding the telltale symptoms that accompany becoming part of the crowd, you will automatically avoid emotionalism. The day after my $248,000 Thursday in August of 1983, Broderick and I were sitting on the dock at his lake house. He turned to me and said, "What's the only thing that can keep this market from really going?" I thought a minute and said, "Well, if it rains, that'll change things." That night we were watching the news and the weather report called for rain over the weekend. Broderick looked at me and said, "Well, that's it, right?" I said, "Well, no, it ain't. It may not be enough rain, and it's not really getting Indiana." It only took me about half an hour to decide that the rain didn't matter. There wasn't enough rain in the right places, and the market had already shrugged off that little bit of rain by closing higher that day. Broderick got out of the market on Monday because it had rained, and I had told him that if it rained, the trade was over. So he got out, and he made money. But me? No, I had to stick and stay and tell myself it hadn't rained enough. I was not going to be tricked out of one of the best trades of the decade by a little rain. I had my own solitary mania going on. To repeat the leitmotif of the book thus far, people lose, really lose, not just have occasional losing trades, because of psychological factors, not analytical ones. Chapter 5. They personalize the market and their positions, chapters 1 through 4, internalizing what should be external losses, chapter 6, confusing the different types of risk activities, chapter 7, and making crowd trades, chapter 8. Is there a single factor common to all of these errors, and can we determine a way to address that factor in order to avoid the errors? Part 3. Tying it all together. 9. Rules, tools, and fools. A fool must, now and then, be right by chance. William Cowper. The final irony of this story is that the bean oil market turned shortly after I blew out in November 1983. If I had been able to stay in the market a little longer, by May 1984, my 540 spreads would have been worth $3,200,000. In hindsight, however, I don't think it would have made any difference. Sooner or later, I was going to lose all of my money, and the later it was, the more I was going to lose. If I had ridden through that valley of death and come out the other side with $3,200,000, somewhere along the line in some other trade, I would have ended up losing $6 million instead of $1,600,000. It just would have postponed the inevitable loss and made it bigger. Is it possible that I might have done some smart things like pay off the house or lock some money away? Maybe, but I still believe that eventually the disaster was going to happen. Why am I so sure it was inevitable? Because even though I had succeeded in many things in life by treating them like games and simply following the rules, that is, freshman English, the MSV test, OCS, and the Honor Graduate Award, I had also succeeded in many other things by breaking the rules. A lot of things I did worked, but shouldn't have. For instance, nobody calls a frat house during rush, asks for a pledge pin, and gets it. Nobody gets elected to the Board of Governors of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange because he wears $600 suits, $50 ties, and bally shoes. Once I realized I was breaking the rules but still succeeding, I thought rules were for everybody else and that I could break them and still succeed. What this means is that sometimes I was breaking the rules whether I knew it or not, and that one time I was going to be wrong. And we will all be wrong sometimes, but not accept or believe it. That approach ensured that when the loss occurred, it would wipe me out. If you occasionally break the rules and still have an unbroken string of successes, you are likely to compound the problem because you assume that you are better than other people and above the rules. Your ego inflates and you refuse to recognize the reality of a loss when it comes. You assume that you will be right. You assume that even if the market is against you, it will come back. Well, if I had an ego problem at $1 million, what kind of problem would I have had if I had ridden through the valley of death and cheated death? If I had survived the loss and the market had gone on to make money for me, my ego problem would have been much worse. Tying it all together. To answer the question posed at the end of the last chapter, yes, there is a common factor that triggers the mental processes, behavioral characteristics, and emotions of a net loser, the uncertainty of the future. In a certain world, we wouldn't have to choose or act. Certainty would replace probability. We wouldn't have the potential for loss, that is, risk, and therefore we wouldn't have any risk activities, created or inherent. We would neither have losses nor experience the five stages of internal loss. In the words of financial editor James Grant, because the future is always unfathomable, there are always buyers and sellers in every market. If the socialists were right, if the future could be accurately divined, markets would disband, because nobody would ever take the losing side of a trade. Since the herd instinct and crowd behavior arise out of our desire to replace uncertainty with certainty, if the future were certain, we wouldn't succumb to emotionalism. Likewise, hope and fear, which are our strongest emotional responses to the uncertain future, wouldn't subject us to personal panics and manias. As it happens, we don't live in a certain world, so we need a way to deal with the uncertain future. Dealing with the uncertainty of the future. All enterprise, all human activity inextricably involves risk for the simple reason that the future is never certain, never completely revealed to us. When dealing with the risk of the uncertainty of the future, you have three choices: engineering, gambling, or speculating. The engineer knows everything he needs to know for a technologically satisfactory answer to his problems. He builds safety margins into his calculations to eliminate any fringes of uncertainty. Therefore, the engineer basically operates in a world of certainty since he knows and controls most, if not all, of the variables which affect the outcome of his work. The gambler, on the other hand, knows nothing about the event on which the outcome of his gambling depends because the distinguishing feature of gambling is that it deals with the unknown. The gambler plays for the excitement, the adrenaline rush. He isn't playing to win. He is just playing. The speculator doesn't have the advantage of the engineer. The rules of natural science will not render the future direction of prices predictable. but the speculator does know more than the gambler, because while the gambler is dealing with pure chance, the speculator has at least some knowledge about what determines the outcome of his activity. Speculating is the application of intellectual examination and systematic analysis to the problem of the uncertain future. Successful investing is the result of successful speculation. If your investment is a stock, you are depending on the managers of the firm to accurately foresee the market for the goods it produces. If your investment is a bank savings account, you are depending on the loan officers at the bank to accurately foresee future business conditions and make prudent, profitable loans that generate the interest the bank pays to you. Interest doesn't just materialize out of thin air simply by putting money in the bank. This is a reference to banking the way it used to be, ignoring FDIC insurance in order to make a point. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan put it this way: "The historic purpose of banking is to take prudent risks through the extension of loans to risk-taking businesses." In other words, the bankers are speculating. Successful trading is also the result of successful speculation. The trader has a methodical approach to bidding and offering stock, or bonds, futures, currencies, etc., and monitoring market conditions for any subtle changes in supply and demand. He knows only too well the perils of predicting and doesn't try to forecast market direction. He operates under strict parameters of if-then statements that dictate his subsequent buy and sell decisions. Successful hedging, too, is a function of successful speculation. The hedger examines current and prospective business and market conditions, and he speculates as to how they might change and whether he can turn a profit at today's prices. If so, he hedges his inventory or inventory needs. Speculation is forethought. And thought before action implies reasoning before a decision is made about what, whether, and when to buy or sell. That means the speculator develops several possible scenarios of future events and determines what his actions will be under each scenario. He thinks before he acts. The sequence of thinking before acting is the exact definition of the word plan. Therefore, speculating and planning are the same thing. A plan allows you to speculate with a long time horizon as an investor, a short time horizon as a trader, or on a spread relationship as a basis trader or hedger. Since you can't really be an engineer in the market, unless you're a rocket scientist on Wall Street, and since we've already discussed the dangers of gambling in the markets, then speculating, and therefore having a plan, is the only way to deal with the uncertainty of the future in the markets. Given this definition, for the remainder of the book, speculator, capitalized, will be used to include investors, speculators, and traders, all of whom are speculating. A plan, the noun, is a detailed scheme, program, or method worked out beforehand for the accomplishment of an objective. To plan, the verb, means to think before acting, not to think and act simultaneously, nor to act before thinking. Without a plan, you fall into one of two categories: a bettor, if your main concern is being right, or a gambler, if your main concern is entertainment. If you express an opinion on what the market will do, you've gotten yourself personally involved with the market. You start to regard what the market does as a personal reflection. You feel vindicated if price moves in the direction you predicted, and wrong if it doesn't. Moreover, when the market moves against you, you feel obligated to say something to justify your opinion. Or, worse, you feel obligated to do something like show the courage of your conviction by adding to a losing position. Participating to be right is betting, and betting for excitement is gambling. In order to be speculating, by definition, you must have a plan. Decision-making. As we saw in Chapter 6, participating in the markets is about decision-making. You must decide the conditions under which you will enter the market before developing a plan to implement the decision. Obviously, if you decide not to enter the market, there is no need for a plan. Broadly speaking, the decision-making process is as follows. 1. Decide what type of participant you're going to be. 2. Select a method of analysis. 3. Develop rules. 4. Establish controls. And 5. Formulate a plan. Depending on what your goals or objectives are on the continuum of conservative to aggressive, you will decide whether you are an investor or a speculator, which in turn will help you decide what markets to participate in, what method of analysis you'll use, what rules you'll develop, what controls you'll have, and how you will implement these things with a plan. We already know that no single analytical method will be successful for everyone. Instead, you are likely to find some type of method that is compatible with your tolerance for exposure. You will fill in the specifics based on your research and your tolerance for exposure. The first thing you decide is what type of participant you are going to be, investor or speculator. Then you select what market you are going to participate in, stocks, bonds, currencies, futures. The plan you develop must be consistent with the characteristics and time horizon of the type of participant you choose to be. Why? Changing your initial time horizon in the middle of a trade changes the type of participant you are and is almost as dangerous as betting or gambling in the market. For example, what's an investment to most people who dabble in the stock market? 90% of the time, an investment is a trade that didn't work. People start with the idea of making money in a relatively short period of time, but when they start losing money, they lengthen their time frame horizon, and suddenly the trade becomes an investment. I really think you ought to buy XYZ here, Jim. It's trading at $20 and it's going to $30. We buy and it goes down to $15. It's really a good deal here at $15. It's going to be fine. So we buy more. Then it goes to $10. Okay, we're talking the long-term view. That's an investment. How many shares of Penn Central are in trust funds in this country? Lots. Because they invested in the Great American Railroad. When it went from $86 in 1968 to $6 in 1970, in their minds they couldn't sell it because they had lost too much. So they lengthened their time frame in order to rationalize hanging on to the losing position. Or how about IBM, the darling of institutional and individual investors alike? Its stock went from $175 in 1987 to $45 in 1993, with buy recommendations from analysts all the way down. One of the problems most stock players face is that they buy the stock because of a fundamental story. They believe a story just like I believed the bean oil story. We're going to run out of bean oil. There's going to be a shortage and people will pay up. If I buy a stock because I think earnings are going to be up, but then the stock starts down, I've got a problem. As a stock player who believed the story, I have to decide either I'm stupid to have believed it in the first place, or the market is wrong. Which do you think I'm going to pick? The market is wrong, of course. So I fight the market, hold the losing position, and turn my trade into an investment. Consider the following story about an individual investor reported by the Wall Street Journal. After seeing the nearly 87% return that 20th century investors' ultra fund racked up in 1991 by concentrating on biotech and computer-related stocks, he took the plunge, paying about $18 a share for the ultra fund. A year later, with ultra shares below $15 a share, he felt stuck. "Some people say cut your losses, but I've already lost too much," the investor said. "Luckily, I don't need the money right now." Well, is the market going to conveniently rebound for him when he does need the money? "I can't get out here, I'm losing too much," is the worst thing you'll hear a trader or investor say. What he is saying is, he's getting absolutely crushed, crucified and buried, and he can't get out of the market because he's getting crushed, crucified, and buried. That's stupid. Anytime someone says he can't get out because he's losing too much, he has personalized the market. He just doesn't want to lose face by realizing the loss. To make matters worse, since most stock players pay for their stock in full, they are very prone to extending their original time horizon. Why? Because they are never forced out of the market when the position starts to lose money. Even when they buy stocks on margin, it's a 50% margin, as opposed to normal 4% to 12% for futures traders. So it's very easy in the stock market to let a loss get out of control simply by lengthening your time horizon and becoming an investor. The stock investor can stay in the position forever. A futures speculator, on the other hand, will be forced out of the market when the contract expires. So even if he has financed a losing futures position, he is forced into making a new decision at expiration as to whether to stay with the position. The stock player has no such forcing point, which is why it's especially important to decide what type of participant you're going to be when you're in the stock market. Next, you must select a method of market analysis that you are going to use. Otherwise, you will jump back and forth among several methods in search of supporting evidence to justify holding onto a market position. Because there are so many ways to analyze the market, you will inevitably find some indicator from some method of analysis that can be used to justify holding a position. This is true for both profitable and unprofitable positions. You will keep a profitable position longer than originally intended and possibly have it turn into a loss. And you will rationalize holding a losing position far beyond what you were originally willing to lose. Your analysis is the set of tools you will use to describe market conditions. Fundamental analysis in the stock market doesn't tell you when to enter the market. There isn't a magic formula combining the various fundamental data that tells you when to buy and when to sell. A certain level of expected earnings combined with its P/E ratio, price-to-book value ratio, and other fundamental variables doesn't specifically instruct you on when to make actual purchases and sales. The different methods of technical analysis don't always offer specific instructions on when to make purchases or sales either. They are a means of describing the conditions of the market. Analysis is simply that. Analysis. It doesn't tell you what to do or when to do it. In order to translate your analysis into something more than mere commentary, you need to define what constitutes an opportunity for you. That's what rules do. They implement your analysis. Rules are hard and fast. Tools, that is, methods of analysis, have some flexibility in how they are used. Fools have neither rules nor tools. You must develop parameters that will define opportunities and determine how and when you will act. How? By doing your homework, that is, research, testing, trial and error, and defining the parameters with rules. Your homework determines what parameters or conditions define an opportunity, and your rules are the if-then statements that implement your analysis. This means entry and exit points are derived after you have done your analysis. If the opportunity-defining criteria aren't met, you don't act. This doesn't mean a particular trade or investment that you pass up won't turn out to be profitable. It might have been an acceptable and profitable trade based on someone else's rules. Remember, participating in the markets is about making decisions. And as Drucker reminds us, there is no perfect decision. One always has to pay a price which might mean passing up an opportunity. You have to accept the fact that profitable situations will occur that you won't participate in. Don't worry about the ones you miss. They were someone else's. Your rules will only enable you to participate in some of the millions of possible opportunities, not all of them. The next step in decision-making is establishing controls, that is, the exit criteria that will take you out of the market either at a profit or loss. They take the form of a price order, a time stop, or a condition stop. That is, if a certain thing happens or fails to happen, then you are getting out of the market. Your exit criteria create a discrete event, ending the position and preventing the continuous process from going on and on. According to Drucker, controls follow